You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live Podcast. Anthem as Ayn Rand's Hymn to Man's Ego.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Ayn Rand Institute's online reading group, where we're discussing Anthem, Ayn Rand's book Anthem. My name is Aaron Smith, and I'll be joined in a moment by my colleague, Augustina Vergara Cid. And just to say a few words about these sessions, this is the third in a series of four sessions we're doing on Anthem, and we're offering the reading group partly because we know a lot of you are already at home, including many students and teachers. You're at home looking for online content, given the current pandemic. And so here we are, and hope you'll find this session interesting. Want to let you also know that we're doing a reading group also on Ayn Rand's novel, The Fountainhead. So it's also on Fridays, so it's today. It occurs about an hour, exactly 1 hour after this session ends. So that's noon Pacific. Also want to remind everyone that we're broadcasting this session live on Zoom, Facebook, and YouTube, and Periscope. But if you want to participate in the live discussion, you'll need to do it through Zoom. So you go to you register on Zoom, and you can click on the Q&A module at the bottom of the tray on your Zoom screen. I'm still sharing my screen here, so you can see that. So that's courses.aynrand.org/webinars/anthem. So you click there to register, and you can join on Zoom if you're not already. That'll allow you to participate. Also want to let you know that we are recording these sessions, so you can start back at the beginning if you want, or watch these at another time, and follow the same link, the one that's on the screen, and you can find the previous sessions there and watch them later or watch them in class. If you like these sessions and you get some value out of it, whether you're a teacher or a student or just someone who is interested in Ayn Rand, feel free to share the link and with anyone who you think might be interested in. We'd love to have them watch. If you're interested in Ayn Rand more generally and her ideas or her novels or works or even life, you can download the Ayn Rand University app and unlock lots of free content. So the app's available for Android and Apple. There are lecture courses, articles, all sorts of material on there. It's free. It is a treasure trove. We've spent a lot of time putting that together. So hope you can enjoy that. I'm going to stop my screen share here and bring in my colleague Augustina. Let me just stop sharing here. Hey, Augustina. Hi. What's going on?
Good.
Okay. Good. The sun finally came out. So we've been deluged here in California with the last several days with rain. It started leaking in my kitchen. moving from California life to our book session. I just want to remind everybody that the very first session that we did, which is available through the link I mentioned, is spoiler free. So we don't assume anybody has read the book, the subsequent sessions, including today, we're assuming that you've actually read the whole book. I mean, it's not a big book, but we're assuming you've read the book. So spoilers ahoy. If you don't want spoilers, you can go back and watch the initial session and escape now. So I'll give you a brief recap of the last session, which I did with Keith Lockich. It was on the theme of individualism versus collectivism, both as a general issue in our culture and as it occurs in the book. So, I mean, the essence of collectivism, and you can see this throughout the whole story, is that the essence of collectivism is the individual exists to serve the group. So every one of you out there, your role in life and in the community and so on is to provide service for the group. It's not to live for your own life, live for your own sake, pursue your own happiness as you live for others. And individualism is the opposite. Individualism is the view that, at least when you're thinking about this in terms of society, it's your life is your own And the good is to live it, to pursue your own values, to pursue your own goals, pursue your own happiness. And you have a moral right to do that. And you don't have an obligation to live for others. If you want to work with others, cooperate with others, and so on, associate with others, sure. But it's on your own terms. And it's not a matter of duty to the community. So we talked about how that plays out in the story. In this session, we're going to focus on Anthem is, and this is how I put the title, is Anthem is Ayn Rand's hymn to man's ego. So we'll talk a bit about what Rand means by the ego and why she thinks a hymn is needed. I mean, hymn, that's a pretty reverent thing for something that we call ego. So we'll talk about that. We're also going to look at what Equality, the main character, Equality 72521, what he initially calls his curse toward the beginning of the book, and he struggles with this throughout the story. And what he calls his curse is his intense desire to know and to value independently in a world that regards this as the cardinal sin. We'll talk about why his view of what he calls his curse changes over the course of the story. And we'll spend some time talking about the final two chapters, mainly chapter 11, the second to last chapter, which Ayn Rand regarded as containing what she said, this is the actual anthem of the book, which is very, very poetic, of course. And Augustine is going to be saying some things about that. Okay, so let's get going.
And we will talk about liberty too.
And liberty, that's right, yeah. And yes, you're going to talk about liberty, yeah. Yeah, you got to love liberty.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Do you have anything you want to add to the kind of the opening remarks before we get started?
No, I think you covered all of it.
Cool. I did it. Okay, so what does Ayn Rand mean by the ego? And why does she think a hymn to man's ego is necessary? Just to say this, ego is just Latin for I. So if you say I went to the store, ego is the word you use, it just means I. But the concept of ego, I think in our own culture, it refers to the self, but the conventional way in which I think people think about ego, right? Ego is the enemy. He's got a big ego. Don't let your ego get in the way, right? It's the ego is often thought about as the source of what's bad or negative or in some sense off-putting, blameworthy about you. And I think most people take it for granted, at least sort of thought, we're supposed to take it for granted, that the greatest kind of moral act that you can engage in really is to live for others, not for yourself, not to prioritize yourself or live for your own sake, but to live for others. And that's certainly the way in which the whole society in Anthem is structured. Only in Anthem, they hold that view all the way down to every aspect. Literally, ego is the enemy. To follow one's ego is the essence of evil in the story. And Rand wants you to rethink this. So she's challenging that whole view of that very negative aspect toward the ego. So what is the ego? What is your self or your I? And Rand's view is that it's fundamentally, it's your mind. It's your reason, your capacity to think, to reach conclusions, to choose your own values, choose your own actions. And by doing that, by choosing your own goals and actions and deciding on what you think is true and what you think is good and what you think is valuable, it's that first-handed approach to arriving at these conclusions. That's how you actually shape your own character. You shape your soul, so to speak, and we don't mean anything religious by that, but it's your character. So it's both, so the self or the I or the ego, it's both your capacity to think and to value. Both of these are functions of the ego or of the self. Your reason, your mind, your thinking capacity is a property of each individual. Like there's no collective brain doing the thinking. It's every individual has to choose to do that for themselves. And the opposite of that is what? It's not to adhere to a collective mind. It's to listen to others. Listen to others, not that right way to put it. It's to allow other people's values, other people's conclusions, other people's view of what's true and good to be a substitute for your own. You let other people's conclusions stand in for your own judgment. And that's the essence of being first-handed, that's the essence of being second-handed. You allow other people's to kind of populate your mind with all the conclusions. Well, so we can talk more about that. later as we go on. But Rand's view is that the ego or the self is actually the fountainhead of what's good, not about what's bad about you. And it's the source of what's best and most admirable in an individual. It's that first-handed use of his own mind and reason to shape his conception of what's true and what's valuable, and to have that as his guiding light in his life. And we can see this that view of the self, I think, dramatized throughout the story through the character of Equality. Because what he calls his curse, you know, in chapter one, I think you can put it as his intellectual independence. I mean, since he was a child, he gets in fights with people. He doesn't listen to his teachers. He kind of breaks the rules, and not because he's a rebel. Well, of course, as a child, you just sort of kind of chafe at orders, and there is a sense in which any kind of more independent minded person, or more someone who has got their own view, I like this and I don't like that, and I think this is true and I don't think that is true. If you have any kind of sense of self-assertion, I think you're going to chafe and bristle at the kind of world that he lives in. Yeah. I mean, we all went to school, right? Right, Augustina?
Yep. And it's also noteworthy that Equality doesn't break, like you said, he doesn't break the rules because he's just a rebel, you know, for the sake of breaking the rules. He breaks the rules because he can, and in the beginning of the book, he thinks he's wrong, of course, but then his thinking evolves. But he does it because the rules, these oppressive rules, get in the way of him achieving his goals. And that's something that he starts, you know, figuring out as he evolves in the book, right?
The very first scene of the book, of course, is he's already broken a lot of rules, and now he's found the tunnel and he's riding on his own and he's already operating more independently. One of the questions he has to grapple with throughout the book is, how do you think about what it is you're doing? Because he frames it as this is a sin, this is evil, and so on. But there's a sense in which he doesn't think it's a sin and he doesn't think it's evil, but he doesn't have any other ways of thinking about that. I mean, and you can think about his curse as it's his intellectual independence. And intellectual doesn't mean he's just brainy, but it's the independence and the way he uses his mind. He thinks for himself, not just about what's true, but about what's good and about what's valuable. And importantly, he doesn't subordinate his understanding to anyone or anything. And I think that's a super important thing for every individual to have. I mean, you remember middle school and high school, Augustina? I mean, come on. I mean, there's so much, I don't know. I think my friends growing up, I weren't so much the sort of peer pressure types. I don't think I gravitated to people like that, but I don't think I got a whole lot of that, but there's a lot of conformity, or at least things you would perceive as conformity. And there's a lot of cliques in school and so on. And it's just, you have to find your own sense of, not like, I'm going to do the opposite of whatever they do, the conventional people do, but it's more like, but who am I? And like, what's important to me?
Exactly. And there's this misunderstanding of what it means. And you have written about this, Aaron, in the past. There's this misunderstanding of what it means to be an individualist, let's say, right? There's this conception like doing the opposite of what everyone does, that's what it means. And that's not what it means. What it means is like thinking for yourself and reaching your own conclusions and judging for yourself, right?
Yeah.
It's not about just being rebellious for the sake of being rebellious, or it's just, you know, thinking for yourself. I think that's one of the key aspects.
Yeah, no, I agree. And because it's how you don't have any other way of doing it. Well, you have two ways of doing it. You either think for yourself, you reach your own conclusions about what you think is true and what you think is good and valuable and so on, or you let other people's opinions just sort of kind of come in, and they just, you don't do your own thinking. It's all secondhand.
Exactly.
They're all borrowed.
Yeah, you don't judge those things that come to you, and you know, they might be right, but they might not be right, or they might be partially right.
Yeah, that's a good point to bring in. It's not that you can't learn from others. I mean, obviously you better learn from others. if your teachers are here, you know, you learn from others. No, but no, there's a ton you have to learn from others. That's the way it is. But you have to judge what it is you're being taught. And you have to think, do I think this is true? And you only know as much as you really understand that it's true, mm-hmm. as opposed to just taking everything on faith or because somebody's an alleged authority. So it's allowing, it's having that first-handed approach to using your mind. Mm-hmm. And what you get in the story is over the course of the story, because equality is thinking independently and as a result, choosing his actions and choices independently, what he winds up forming are very personal conclusions and personal values. So these are things he knows for himself and he himself thinks is important or good, irrespective of what anyone else thinks. So Augustina, you were saying earlier that he, you know, when he was in school, you know, he said, we did not listen to the history of all, we did not listen well to the history of all the councils and all the leaders of the past. And he found this totally boring. But he says, but we love the science of things. Mm-hmm. So they had some sort of, I mean, it's a very primitive society, but they had some sort of science classes or whatever you learn about the candle. But nonetheless, it's like, he was like, oh, this is how you come to understand things, like how things work. And he became really kind of passionate about that. Too passionate for the society. He's asking too many questions and they're telling him shut up. And at the council, for example, we've discovered all truths and there's nothing more to discover, nothing more to learn. He learns otherwise. But then he also has his own personal preferences. And preferences, not just sort of arbitrary, but he has his own personal values. Like for example, the character International 48818, right? They're friends. And there's a wonderful passage. I think it's in chapter one, right? Where they discover the tunnel.
Yeah.
And he said something like, that International and I are friends. We don't speak of it, you know, but we know of it when we look at each mm-hmm. other, you know, because they're not allowed to have, you know, it's the sin of preference, right? You're not supposed to prefer.
Yeah, exactly.
But nonetheless, he says, I like this guy, so to speak. And they feel kind of kindred spirits in a way. And same thing with Liberty. I mean, the woman, he prefers her to others. And it's all about trying to find out what you think is true, what you think is good and valuable and important. And it's that firsthand focus. And I think you could say the same thing is true of Liberty. I mean, we talk a lot about equality because he's the central character, of course. But I think, you know, you can say the same thing about Liberty.
Yeah, absolutely. One last, before we go to Liberty, I'd like to say just briefly, one thing that, you know, in equality's evolution, you can see throughout the book how his thinking evolves. And in the beginning, he thinks, you know, he starts with saying that it is a sin to write this, but that's what he thought at that particular time that the context of knowledge that he had at that point in time. And I think one of the things that, you know, happened in this book is that his context of knowledge, like his knowledge gets, you know, more abundant and he starts, you know, thinking about things more. He starts learning more, and that's how his thinking evolves. But at the beginning, you know, he could only, you know, he had only certain context of knowledge that he could, you know, use to, you know, judge. And then that context is bigger, and that's partly how he evolves, right?
Yeah. And I think partly I think it's entirely because exactly the way in which he approaches, the way in which he approaches life in his thinking, it's his commitment to think and to use his mind to understand the world around him and not letting anything stand in the way or be subordinate his own judgment for that. I mean, so he, you know, when he finds the tunnel, he decides, no, we're not going to tell anybody about this. Yeah, that's wrong. It's a sin. It's illegal mm-hmm. or whatever. And he said, no, this is our spot. He chooses that, and he spends his time writing and thinking. And I think it's interesting too, the way she does the novel. I mean, everything's told, it happens here, but he's talking about the past, and he's in effect journaling, you know, he's writing about his experiences, and that's the way you kind of get the sense of the novel. But what you get to with if anybody does journaling, I don't really journal, but if you do that, a lot of it is putting your thoughts on paper. you're putting your thoughts down and you're putting your thinking down. And that's, so that's the way you get to see a lot of what equality's developing thinking is looking like. And he regularly questions throughout the book. It's, you know, we're told that we should be happy to live for others. You know, now what does he do? Go, oh, okay, that's true. And, you know, put that in my pocket and I'll believe that. If I look around you, I mean, when I look around myself, everybody looks kind of broken and defeated and their shoulders are slumped and their eyes are dull and they're not interested in it. They sure don't look happy, you know, but we're taught to think of that feeling in myself when I feel like when he's in the tunnel and he feels alone and he feels happy, but we're taught to feel that that's evil. And he's, you know, and he still puts it in that category because he doesn't know where else to put it. But he starts to think, how can you call this feeling evil? And when he escapes later to the forest, he's like, he feels so liberated. He's like, for the first time, it's like this kind of feeling. And it makes us wonder, about the fact that we were told that this is what's evil, this is what's wrong. He doesn't have a new conception, but he realizes something's really, really wrong with it. So liberty.
Liberty, I love liberty. Both the character and the concept, but we're going to talk about the character here a little bit. So like you said, just like equality, liberty is, you know, an independent thinker, like equality comes to be, right? And she makes choices and takes action to achieve, what the values that she has, that she has come to have, right? She interacts with equality, which is forbidden. She follows him to the forest and does all of the things, you know, to achieve her goals. And you mentioned earlier something that equality comes to realize, and that the same goes for liberty, that friendship, you know, and love require, you know, choice and require independent thought. And they are functions of the self. No one can, choose those for you. No one can tell you who to value. You have to make that decision on your own based on your thinking and your judgment, right? And liberty, like equality, chooses her values and makes her decisions that, you know, like an independent person. So they are very, very similar characters, even though, you know, because equality is the main character, you know, the focus is on him, right? But Liberty also, you know, she has a mind of her own and she refuses to obey the authorities and these oppressive rules, right? And she violates these rules in order to pursue her goals. And again, it's not, you know, like we said before, it's not just for the sake of doing it, for the sake of being rebellious. These oppressive laws are getting in the way of her achieving her values and her goals, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, she does this like so many times throughout the book. She, you know, she observes and looks at equality, you know, and she thinks of him, even though it's forbidden, you know, for a woman to notice a man outside of a certain context. And, you know, she talks to him, she smiles at him, you know, if you pay attention to how their interactions happen, she takes the initiative with equality always, right? And she even gives him, you know, a name, which is the Unconquered. And
she's the first to give him a name.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I have many favorite scenes in this book, but that's one of my favorite scenes when, you know, they're trying to tell each other what names they're giving each other.
And it's relevant. It's relevant too. I mean, in the story, I mean, what's her name? Liberty. What's it? That girl, Liberty. I mean, she's only she's only 17.
Exactly. That's one of the things.
Yeah.
Worth mentioning. That you know she makes all these choices, and let's not lose sight of the fact that she's only 17 years old. She's very young, and.
And in control of herself, you can tell.
I mean, exactly. And like I was saying, like Liberty gives equality the name the Unconquered. And I think the reason why she gives him this name is because she admires equality for his, you know, unbroken spirit. you know, that he has not let these oppressive rules and this oppressive society break his spirit. But also she herself demonstrates her own, you know, unconquered spirit in forming these thoughts and these judgments about equality and then about, you know, her choices and her own values, right?
Yeah.
And in the end, like towards the end of the novel, you know, she has to choose. She has to make a very important and crucial choice, which is, you know, between this, like staying in the society that she lives in, which is, you know, the only life she has ever known. And again, let's remember that she's 17 and she's having to make this very important choice.
So and the choice between staying 5 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Like she has to make this choice between like staying in this oppressive society and risking her life, you know, to follow equality to the forest and go into this, you know, unknown life that she doesn't know how it's gonna turn out. But she does not hesitate to leave, right? And there's a quote that I really like from her. Let me pull it up. And she says, "We wish to be damned with you rather than blessed with all of our brothers." And I like that quote a lot. And I think that liberty, you know, embodies one of the things that Ayn Rand wants to get across in this book, right? That independent persons form values of their own and think for themselves. And because she thinks for herself, like because Liberty thinks for herself, she values for herself as well.
Yeah, and I think it's also, it's also the root of their sense of self, their sense of who they are. And it's also, I think, the root of self-esteem. And you know, they have self-esteem. They really are, my life is important, you know, and I'm good. And not just for some frivolous reason. Yeah.
And she knows what she wants and she goes after it. And she does not let, you know, like most of the people around her, she does not let society get, you know, get like control of her and replace her own judgment. And I think these are some of the reasons why she's a heroine in the book.
Yeah. Let's talk about chapter 11. Because chapter 11, it's almost a poem, in effect. It's maybe not a poem, but it's very poetic. And it's what, you know, Ayn Rand called, this is the real anthem of the book. So the book is a buildup to, in effect, the grasp of the points that equality makes there. And this is the hymn, so to speak. I mean, we think of a hymn, it has tones of something sacred, something for which you should feel some kind of reverence. And you wanted to talk about that. And I'll chime in here and there and we'll get some material out here.
Yeah. So, you know, chapter 11 begins by equality writing, "I am, I think, I will," which is, I think, a very big contrast with how the book begins, which is, you know, he writes, "It is a sin to write this." And equality, you know, finally discovers this lost word that is more than a word, it's actually an idea for which, you know, remember the scene where the signs of the pirate, you know, was burned at the stake for, right? And this vocabulary that he uses, "I am, I think, I will," I think shows that he now understands and has acquired the vocabulary of freedom in a way, right? And I think these words, like the way this chapter opens, carry the meaning and power of his liberation from this oppressive society, from slavery, right? In both physical form and intellectual or spiritual, in the intellectual or spiritual way as well, right?
Yeah.
And I think also, you know, one of the purposes of this chapter is to explain what the alternative is to all these events that we have seen so far. You know, we've seen throughout the book that the subordination of the individual to the group, so, you know, collectivism, leads to the destruction of the human soul. And now is where, you know, Rand presents through, you know, through equality's findings, an explanation of what the alternative to that morality looks like, right?
Yeah.
What the alternative is, because she presents here, Ayn Rand presents here through, you know, equality, a new moral code of its own, right? Which is the opposite and the alternative to this other oppressive code that is present in equality society, right? And,
yeah. What do you take to be the kind of how would you summarize something like the essence of the message of like what he's come to grasp, you know?
Yeah. So this chapter it's short and it's my favorite chapter because it has so much in it, and so he discovers this new moral code, right? So equality had been searching for like a meaning in life, right? And now he discovers, like he says, I believe in the first or second page of the chapter, he says he discovers that he is the meaning, and he wanted a warrant for existing, but now he realizes he doesn't need a warrant. He can live for his own sake, right? He has a right to his own life, and he doesn't need to be granted, you know, permission from anyone else, right? And he realizes that his mind, and only his mind, is what, you know, can think, and no one can think for him, right? And also, one of the main aspects is that he discovers that happiness is possible to him here on Earth, meaning, and I believe he puts it that way, here on Earth. And he doesn't need to justify that happiness to others. His happiness is an end, you know, in itself. And I think the way he puts it is it's its own goal and it's its own purpose.
Yeah, but I think if you put that just in philosophical terms, I mean, it's, you know, just to step for just a second in part outside of that chapter, I mean, it's Rand's view is that, and what she's trying to express here is that, express as well, but it's that every one of you, so every individual, you have the right to live for your own sake. That you don't need a justification, mm-hmm. somebody's approval, somebody's warrant, as she puts it, like here you can now live, or you don't need permission. You don't need to, there's nothing, your life is an end in itself. And what that means is it's not the means to some other goal.
Exactly.
So you like, what am I, 47? So I got another maybe 40 years to live. I don't need approval. And there's nothing higher above that. I don't need this think, well, I can pursue my own goals or my own happiness only if somebody approves or somebody says it's okay, or I do these things. That there's nothing higher and above the pursuit of one's own happiness and the achievement of one's happiness. You don't have to justify it by saying, oh, well, I'm going to be happy so that I can serve the community. It's an end in itself. And when at the beginning of the chapter, I mean, the chapter before, he discovers the word I, you know, in these books. And he has to get, that's what that means. And I think that's when the final integrations he puts together, and mm-hmm. he's, that's what I've been struggling with the whole time. And because the opposite view is, no, your happiness is not an end in itself. You need a justification to live. And the justification, as we're often presented, and it's presented in the novel, is that, you know, if you're living for others, then it's okay to live. But it's as long as you're living for others. And I think there's that real sense of when he reflects on himself and this new way of thinking about his self and I, and he looks back on this whole doctrine that he's been taught, like that the group is everything, the individual is nothing. And he can come to see this as just deeply, deeply wrong. And this is Ayn Rand's own journey and her own thinking. It's mm-hmm. she's growing up in the Soviet Union, where all the propaganda is about, you know, you should live for others. The individual is nothing. You serve the collective and so on. And she thought, even as a young person, thought this is terrible, you know, but it took her time to figure out. And she said she was an individualist, like from the outset, but to get to grasp the point that the whole way we think about morality is wrong. I mean, everything is, it's about what you do for others and it's others. And it's, her view is no, it's how you conduct yourself and how you use your mind to pursue your own life and your own happiness. And that's what's radical. That's the essence of morality for her. Not just, yeah, that's okay. You can do that sometimes. It's okay to be happy, but serve others on your spare time. It's no, the essence of morality is to pursue and achieve your own happiness. And not just any sort of random whim, but you figure out what your life requires, what real values you need to pursue, what methods you need to use to function and to really achieve something. And I mean, certainly equality does. And I think liberty does in her own way too. And so we don't get to see too much into the future, but you get a projection in the last chapter. So we should probably move to questions, but go ahead. And if you've got some additional points.
No, just that, you know, like we were saying, like he realizes that he is not the means to the ends of others, but also others are not the means to his own ends, right?
Yeah.
And I like the quote when he says, you know, that he will choose friends among, I can't remember.
I will choose friends among my fellow humans, or something like that.
But neither masters nor servants. And he also, another thing that he realizes is, says that an individual is not to sacrifice on their altars.
So it's not just I refuse to be sacrificed for other people. It's like I'm not going to sacrifice anybody else for my own goals. So you exist to serve your own life. You don't exist to serve my goals, and I don't either. So it's I like that too, because it helps highlight it's not this sort of predatory view of self-interest. So why don't we move on to some questions here? We got a bunch of questions coming in. I just want to remind people that if you're on Zoom and you want to ask questions, you can go down to the little Zoom thing right at the bottom of the tray. It says Q&A, and you can click on there and punch in questions. If you're not already on Zoom, you can go to the link I shared earlier. It's courses.aynrand.org. It's a big mouthful, /webinars/anthem. But at any rate, let's take a look at the questions here. I'm looking at the questions in the Zoom. The chat thing is a little harder for me to follow, but let me look up with the Zoom. Just give us a second here, and I'm going to pop open the chat. Okay, so let's take a look here. So why don't you, I'm going to look at some questions, and in the meantime, why don't you scroll through these and see what you think are that we can get to here.
Okay, sounds good.
So Mohini asked a question on the Zoom chat. If equality's world wasn't, like in the world in Anthem, wasn't meant to have any people who stood out, wouldn't the fact that there is a world council and a home of the leaders undermine this idea? Well, there's a sense in which those people don't stand out. I mean, so they have more power. They have more, they've been granted more authority, but they're no more independent thinkers or achievers than any of the drones in the society. They're just drones with power. So, and they're older perhaps, and if, you know, they've obeyed orders enough to get political positions, so to speak. They don't think for themselves like a jot.
They don't have any, you know, sense of individuality or anything like that. When he's in front of the council, you know, when they choose what his career is going to be, you know, equality says that, you know, they had absolutely no expressions on their face. They just looked like drones, basically.
Yeah. And their reaction to the light, it's not like, oh, wow, that's an achievement. Yeah, that's amazing.
Exactly.
Like, they didn't even try to steal it.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, destroy it. I think partly that's psychological. I mean, that whole method of functioning, if they agree that this is an achievement, how can you have the approach to society and to individuals that you do? It's totally undermining. Got a question here from Brandon. This is a good question. He says, we develop our own values. So how do we respond to other people's differing opinions? Is it acceptable to build on our own to build our own values off of other people's opinions? So he says, Prometheus rejects the collectivist views, but he accepts the teaching of the books he finds in the house. So basically, if you're forming your own values and your own conclusions and your own goals, what about the conclusions and values and goals that others have? And the answer to that is you retain your individuality by judging those goals. So if I can learn something from Augustina and Augustina can learn something from me, but it's not just because she just nods her head and yes, sir, no, sir. It's, that's not the way it works. It's, you have to think about that. And it's like, no, if you independently come to think, yeah, no, I think that you're right. I think that is true. Then you come to see for yourself that it's good. And similarly with values. I remember when I was in high school, there was a little cliquey group of people that I didn't like. And there was a certain shirt brand that they would wear, and it was really stylish, and they're all cliquey, and they all wore the same shirt. And some of my friends were like, yeah, I'm not getting that stuff. I'm not gonna be like them. And my view was, I actually kind of like those shirts. I was very independent, but it was like the fact that the cliquey people happen to wear it is completely irrelevant. The idea is like, no, I actually like it. I think it's good. And so like, yeah, I'm gonna wear that. So it's again, you have to think about what you think about the things and only adopt the things that you really think are true or good. It's not about whether you get them from somebody else or whether you're some firsthand originator.
Yeah, and I wanted to add to that something that I think it's important to clarify in this session is that what Rand is trying to do here, she's not trying to say that living in a society is wrong or that, you know, it goes against, achieving your happiness. That's not what she's saying. Actually, what living in a society is very, very valuable for people. And, you know, one of the main things that you get from a society is, you know, you get to trade and acquire knowledge from others, you know, and build on that knowledge. And, but, you know, as long as a society doesn't lose sight of the individual and the fact that an individual is an end on itself, which is radically different from what the society in Anthem looks like, right?
Yeah. And let me grab a question here by Steve. It's kind of related to that a bit. He says, it seems to me that there's a greater respect in our society for thinking for yourself than there is for acting for your own benefit. Do you think this is true? If so, why would this be? I think it's definitely true. Because you often hear that. My parents, at least, often told me to think for myself. I mean, that was don't just accept something because somebody told you. They didn't say that about religion, there is a general acknowledgement that, you know, you ought to think for yourself, but to act for your own benefit is to be selfish. But Rand's view is thinking for yourself is selfish. And so there's something wrong with the way we think about selfishness. Her view of a selfishness is it's a self-directed, self-focused life. And I mean, thinking is something the self does. It's something you have to do, you choose to do, and it's selfish in motive. I want to understand. I want to know what's true. I want to figure things out so that I can have the knowledge I need to navigate the world, to deal with life. And so it's very self-interested. It's deeply self-interested. And to the idea that you would think for yourself, come to your own conclusions, but Jesus, don't act on it. You know, don't. Live in accordance with your own values or happiness. Don't do that. That's not moral. She thinks that's really wrong. Her view is it is moral, and you shouldn't have that sort of dichotomy, that split.
I agree with that.
So you want to answer Michelle's question? That's about liberty.
Oh. What is your response to the claim that the character of liberty goes against the ideas of feminism, such as her depiction of doing the biddings of equality? So I take the question as being like, it shows her kind of like as kind of submissive and, you know, just blindly following him, following the man or something like that. Like I said before, I don't think that is the case at all. I think she's an independent thinker. And like I said, if you think about it, she is the one that initiates the action with him, all the action that goes on between them. And she independently decides to follow him. I mean, and that, like I said, like shows a lot of bravery and you know, self-esteem and the fact that she really wants to pursue these goals, because it would have been so easy for her to just stay where she was, stay in that society that she knows, instead of just literally risking her life and going for, you know, the unknown. But she decides independently she does not want to do that. Remember, she follows him to the forest. He doesn't say, follow me. She does it independently, right? Yes. So I think...
And she doesn't even know whether he's going to want to... I mean, they exactly. Have a kind of a bond, but they've met... a number of times at the hedge. Mm-hmm. And that's basically all they have. And she's been told that, you know, that people who enter the forest die. Yep. So, I mean, so I think she's enormously independent. Mm-hmm. I think what you get, and I mean, everybody asks this when they read Anthem. Everybody asks this, it's super common. So it's not weird that somebody would have a question like this. It's perfectly normal.
Absolutely.
But what she's dramatizing and trying to present in literary form is the enormous admiration that liberty has for equality, and I think ought to have. And think about too, is like, but put, challenge this sort of view that she's just does his bidding. I don't think it's at all true that if he says, yeah, go back and live with the other people, that she would just do it. Or jump off a bridge, or don't think for yourself, just listen to whatever I say and don't use your own mind to judge it. She'd tell him where to go. So it's, I mean, she has her own mind. And so it's. I think a lot of this is symbolic. It's trying, well, symbolic is maybe not quite the word. It's a way to try to dramatize the admiration and I think real reverence that she feels to him. But it's not just she'll do whatever he says. So we got a question from Anna. How can we teach children to value ego or their self in a society that's constantly opposing it? In an interview, Ayn Rand said that the Montessori method was an option. Do you agree? Well, I'm not a specialist in education. I know some things about Montessori method in the way in which it teaches a child independence. And I think firsthand thinking. So, I mean, you can look into that yourself, but Ayn Rand thought very highly of the Montessori method. Not that it's perfect or something, but it thought very highly of the basic orientation of it. But how do you teach children to value themselves in a society? Don't push them to... So first of all, you need to allow them some independence. I don't mean free reign, do whatever they want, but you need to allow them some independence so that they can start to form their own personal values and their own ideas. And you have to guide some of that, of course. I mean, you're a parent, you know, but it's, and don't push them to, I don't know, compromise in ways that, compromise is another word. Don't push them to subordinate their own real goals and things to society or to other people. It's okay to pursue your own goals and values. And as they grow up and they start to mature, they have to start to figure out, yeah, which goals really are worth pursuing. I mean, it's not that a kid knows exactly what they're doing, but as people start growing up, and like I said, there's middle schoolers and high schoolers, you start to become, you're moving toward adulthood. And you start to becoming more aware that, look, I'm much more independent. That's why, the way, teenage years, I think everybody goes crazy, you know, partly because they're becoming much more independent. They start thinking, no, I don't have to just agree and obey everything. It's like I did when I was little. It was, no, I'm starting to come into my own here a bit. Mm-hmm. And I have my own views and I have to think about what's worth pursuing and what's really worth believing. And in the process of that, you have to be able to foster that process, that independent, first-handed approach. You don't always have to agree with what your kids think, but let them think firsthand. I think that, and I think they'll come to value themselves.
And also, I don't have children, but from remembering my own childhood and teenage years, also, you know, to the extent that you can, given, you know, taking into account your child's context of knowledge and mental maturity, don't just say, you know, because I say so, do this because I say so. Explain, you know, the reason why he or she has to do certain things or why he or she shouldn't do certain things. Try to explain that thought process, not to, you know, say, because when you say because I said so, it's like follow authority, you know, blindly.
Obey.
That's essentially what you're saying.
Obey, you're saying. Shut down your mind. Don't think, obey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, this is the same thing with the state.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, your command in your role isn't to think or to question, it's to obey. I'm going to look at the window here. So I'm looking at a question from Brandon. This is another question about liberty. He says that, again, this is another question that she says she displays servility. Again, I don't think that's the right way to think about it. In the question chat here, it says, not chat, but Zoom module. Bowing before Prometheus and saying that he can do whatever he wills with her. again, I think this is partly symbolic and partly because of who Prometheus is to her. I mean, what Prometheus will do to her is love her, protect her, value her, admire her. And it's a kind of, if there's a painting that Ayn Rand loved, and I think it was her favorite painting, and it's the Crucifixion of Christ, I think it is, by Salvador Dali. And she thinks, and if you can Google that if you want, and her Ayn Rand's view was, this is how I think, this is how I feel, put it that way. And you can take a look at that and see what you think. Let's see here. I didn't really look much in the chat. I was looking at the other questions. You want to take a look in the chat and see if there's something? I'm going to scroll a bit through the questions.
Remember, we have the questions that were submitted earlier too.
Is there a particular one you want to address?
Let me take a look.
Okay, so Renee asks a question. You can check there. I'll look in the Zoom. He said, thanks for the discussion. I'm a high school senior who's submitting an essay this year for the contest. Okay, cool. That's good. And you said, my question is, in what ways are we all almost forced to participate in a collectivist society? It's like, say, through taxes or conformity and so. Well, yeah, I mean, there are ways in which one has to, in one's own actions, let's say pay your taxes or obey certain laws that you think are, I mean, the rule of law is great. I mean, Rand's view is that the government is a super necessary feature for a social, for living together. But there are certain things that I think are definitely wrong, certain kinds of laws that are wrong or inappropriate in ways that invade on your own rights and so on. But in many cases, you just have to comply with them because the government has the guns and you're going to go to jail. So in some cases, there are actions that one has to take. Which aren't in your own interests. On the other hand, the essence of it is to not subordinate your mind to it, to say, well, you know, I guess this is how we should live, and, you know, give up your own judgment about what you think is true or what you think is right. And in that way, you can retain your autonomy as a person, as a thinker. Because, I mean, even there's a sense in which even a slave, an actual slave, retains a certain amount of autonomy in the sense that if he thinks this is wrong, he thinks the fact that he's being made a slave is wrong. He thinks his slave owner is in the wrong and that he has the right to live for his own life and that he is a value no matter what other people tell him. There's a sense in which he can retain a kind of his own soul, even in that crushing kind of environment. And I think this is similar to what Anthem has to go through. And I mean, wouldn't put our current state of the culture bad as it is. I wouldn't put that as anyway. It's a kind of crushing kind of environment, but it's one in which you there's so many pressures to, you know, to conform and obey and serve the group and not pursue your own interests. So we got about 5 minutes left. Go ahead.
Yeah. Just a short answer to another question related to, you know, I think liberty a little bit. There's a question that was pre-submitted. Do you believe there is a gap between male and female in the Anthem world? Well, there most certainly is a gap in the society because that's how society is structured. You know, men have certain jobs, women have other types of jobs, and they have to be separate at all times, except for, you know, when they mate. And but when it comes to Rand's exploration of the character of liberty, I don't think there is a gap between liberty and equality. The only difference there, I mean, we've been saying, like, they're both independent thinkers, they share a lot of qualities, and the only difference is that, you know, the main character is equality, and the focus is on him, and the focus is not on liberty as much. I mean, if we got to see a little bit more of what liberty does, we will get more from her. But in that sense, there is no gap. But in the society of Anthem, yes, there is a gap, you know, a difference between male and female.
Yeah, I think take another question from Nancy. She says she read Anthem for the first time a couple of months ago, and she has a concern about the ending of the book. She said, in the end, our two protagonists don't find another community of other people with the same opinions as people do in the book Fahrenheit 451. But they seem to live totally alone. So does Ayn Rand equate individuality with loneliness? No. I mean, two things, one about the issue, one about the book. In the last chapter, he says, he said, when I shall have read all the books and learned my new way, when my home will be ready and my earth tilled, I shall steal one day for the last time into the cursed city of my birth. I shall call to me my friend who has no name, save International 48818, and all those like him. Fraternity, etc., who cries without reason, solidarity, who calls for help in the night, and a few others. I shall call to me all the men and the women, whose spirit has not been killed within them and who suffer under the yoke of their brothers. They will follow me and I shall lead them to my fortress. And here in this uncharted wilderness, I and they, my chosen friends, my fellow builders, shall write the first chapter in the new history of man. So it's a discussion of a rebuilding. And when he talks about, that Gaia, Liberty, is pregnant with his first child. And it's like they're building anew. So it's not like they're going to live as hermits or something. But I mean, as a matter of fact, that's how they wound up in the story, because they're the first people to. And for all we know, there could be others out there. There could be others. Sorry. Coffee time. That they simply haven't found yet. But yeah. And no, not individuality with loneliness. Individuality is primarily the way in which you orient yourself toward your thinking and toward your valuing and toward the way you conduct yourself. It's not about being alone, per se. Oh, we got 3 minutes left. Go ahead.
Yes. Maybe we should. No, I was just going to add something really brief to that. It's like we were discussing before, she's not trying to say that living in a society or living with others is wrong or in any kind of way. It's just that, it actually living in a society is really beneficial for individuals. For many reasons. I've said a couple before. But
got a question from Caitlin. I don't quite understand why the title of the book is called Anthem. Is there any significance? Yeah, when you think about an anthem, you think about the national anthem, right? It's something you stand for. At least you used to put your hand on your heart. I mean, we did this in school when we were kids. But it's expressing something reverent. It's that you should feel some kind of reverence for. And I think also a kind of a dedication toward, a commitment. And I think that's what the purpose of it was. Every morning in class, you'd stand up. They don't do that anymore, I don't think, but maybe it's somewhere. You'd say the national anthem. And it was the idea that you rededicate yourself, to something noble. And I think this is part of what this anthem means. But the anthem here isn't to, the United States of America or whatever. Or to my country, it's to the self, a man's ego, so to speak. That's my response to that. So Caitlin asked a good question. This is a very philosophical question. I don't know, Caitlin, if you're a student or an adult or not, but that's an adult question. So the question is, and this question gets asked to people who are interested in Ayn Rand a lot. What if your happiness is to fulfill and help others' goals and happiness? Oh, there's a lot to unpack there that we can't. So, man, it's 1 minute left. So I'll just say this, two things. One, you have to think about which values actually, in fact, enhance and enrich your own life. And they really do that, and that they're not working at counter purposes. So I'm a teacher. I help people all the time. All of what I do is I help people. Some people make computers and they're helping people. So the idea is not about helping people. It's about, are you subordinating yourself to other people? Are you subordinating your own life and your happiness to other people and letting that dictate how you live your life? Or are you finding your happiness in some kind of endeavor, some kind of profession that actually brings value to other people, but it's interesting to you? And it really does advance your life. That's the kind of the split we're talking about here. So we are out of time. So I want to say a few things here. Let me close a couple of things here. figure out what I want to say because we're going over and now I'm being bad. Okay. I want to remind people in 1 hour, There's also a discussion on Ayn Rand's novel, The Fountainhead. I'm not going to be in that one, but that's there for you if you want to check it out. I want to remind you that the next session, so let me go back to my screen share here.
Next session. Then,
yeah, here we go.
The relevance of Anthem in our world today.
Yeah, and for that one, I'm going to be joined, I think, by Ankar Gatte. So We'll see how that turns out. So I just want to say we're all out of time. So I just want to say thanks a lot, everybody, for showing up. Glad to have you here. And thanks, Augustina, for
Thank you, Aaron. And thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye, everybody. Bye.
Thank you all.
You've been listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a review, share with a friend, and subscribe to our other podcasts. This podcast is made possible by donors to the Ayn Rand Institute. Help support this podcast by becoming an ARI member. Go to AynRand.org/membership.